I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. It's an unfortunate reality that our world sees alarming disparities between the developed and developing world, the first and third world, to use somewhat archaic terms. In terms of life expectancy alone, those in the West can expect to live into their 80s, while those in the developing world barely make it past 40. There's been not much advancement in medicine, what with designer drugs and treatments for diseases unheard of a decade or two ago, not to mention genetic research that's looking at our DNA, as well as biotechnology with regards to genetically modified crops. Joining me now to wade through all of these issues of ethics and morality, science and technology, are Dr. Abdullah Dar and Dr. Peter Singer. They are the authors of a new book. Its premise is rather simple, but it also challenges how we look at ourselves and each other with its thought-provoking ideas on how to remedy the inequities. The book is called The Grandest Challenge, Taking Life-Saving Science from Lab to Village. The doctors Dar and Singer are at the forefront of all of this biotechnology and are passionate about saving millions of lives. Dr. Abdullah Dar is a professor of public health sciences and of surgery at the University of Toronto and director of ethics and commercialization at the McLaughlin Rotman Center for Global Health. He is also chief science and ethics officer of Grand Challenges Canada. Dr. Peter Singer is the director of the same McLaughlin Rotman Center for Global Health and is a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. He is the chief executive officer of Grand Challenges Canada. Both have advised many governmental and non-governmental organizations. The book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome in Toronto this day to the Plant Online program, Dr. Abdullah Dar and Dr. Peter Singer. Good morning, Dr. Singer.
Hello.
And good morning, Dr. Dar.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us both. Dr. Singer, I'll begin with you. I mentioned these two organizations that you both belong to, the McLaughlin Rotman Center and Grand Challenges Canada. What are they?
Well, what they have in common is they're both interested in global health innovations, like the type that we describe in the book. The Rotman Center is an academic unit that does research on these problems and helps solve problems. We have work in ethics, work in malaria research, and we host Grand Challenges Canada. Grand Challenges Canada is a great Canadian story. It's an independent organization that's funded by Canada's foreign aid that funds global health innovations, mostly innovators in low and middle-income countries. Canada was the first country to take a Grand Challenges approach to innovation in its foreign aid envelope, and it's enabling the sorts of things we're about to describe to actually happen on the ground and make a difference, because innovation saves lives.
And in terms of where you're going, the village, as it were, you've identified those areas, have you?
Yep. So, I mean,
Are they specific places, I guess?
The title of the book. The book is called The Grandest Challenge, Bringing Life-Saving Science from Lab to Village. And village, of course, there is a metaphor for the villages and the cities in the developing world where people suffer, in many cases, intolerable and inexcusable health problems. So the grandest challenge has to do with the fact that in Canada we live 80 years and longer, and in many parts of the low- and middle-income countries, 40 years and fewer. And that's a huge ethical challenge that science and innovation can have a role in addressing and even in some cases solving.
And Dr. Dar, you're the Director of Ethics and Commercialization at MRC. What does your role entail?
In the context of the book, we have been working closely together for the past 10, 12 years, and the book describes the journey that started when we first met in Toronto soon after my eldest sister died of malaria, and I began to ask whether what I was doing as a transplant surgeon, as opposed to what I could be doing as a global health practitioner, was the right thing to do. And my conclusion was that it was not. I needed to work to help many more people than the few patients that one treats in a day or a few in a week. So since around 1999, we have been working together, developing programs to bring modern life-saving science to where it's needed most. And the metaphor of the village is not necessarily in all cases the village per se, but the patients who need the interventions that can be developed using modern science. So we've been working together as a team, leading the centers that we've created all along. Now Peter heads a new center called a new initiative called Grand Challenges Canada. That is probably the most exciting policy initiative in foreign aid we've seen in the last two or three decades in Canada.
And in terms of sort of the ethical issues and the sort, is that something that is a source of debate, I guess, within your organizations, Dr. Durr?
A lot of the things that we describe in the book are controversial. There are also things in the book like clinical trials in developing countries, releasing of mosquitoes into the environment and so on. These require very deep ethical reflection. And we describe our work in the area of ethics and the work of our colleagues. Our book is very much a story of a journey along which we encounter remarkable people. And many of the people that we describe in the book, like Dr. Jim Lavery, Dr. Jerome Singh, are ethicists that work with us. So yes, I do deal with ethics, and we also highlight many ethicists in the book.
In terms of the protests, not necessarily protests, but sort of the opposition to some of the controversial things in this book, how do they manifest themselves? I mean, do you get letters regularly?
Peter, do you want to take that, or should I?
Go ahead, Ethel.
Well, we meet various sorts of resistance. I mean, first of all, you read the papers and you see people protesting or writing about resistance to things like genetically modified crops and controversial treatments and so on. Our perspective on this is really quite simple. We do not take necessarily a position for or against anything. What we say is, or we ask, is who should be making the decision? So if you're talking about a genetically modified crop, who should be making the decision, a bureaucrat sitting in Brussels or the people that are affected in the poor countries and the policymakers that work with them and hopefully listen to them? And what we are calling for is what we call community engagement. And we want people to be involved in those decisions by being informed honestly, objectively, and accountably, so that they can make the decisions whether to work with those technologies or not to work with them.
So I'm a layman, so I don't know much about, or anything really, about genetic research, biotechnology, and the sort. Dr. Singer, what advancements in medical science account for the life expectancy in this part of the world to increase? Is it simply that we have access to things that people in the developed world don't?
Well, let's take some straightforward examples. So one of the great things that happened earlier this year was a meningitis vaccine. You know, meningitis is a disease of children. It kills them. It disables them. And there were different strains of meningitis in Africa for which no vaccine existed. Such a vaccine was developed by a not-for-profit in Seattle, the World Health Organization, and very significantly manufactured and developed by a company in India. To apply to meningitis problem in Africa. That vaccine was rolled out earlier this year. It costs less than 50 cents per dose, and it is expected to save the lives of 130,000 children over the next 10 years. So that's the kind of innovation we're talking about that can save lives, and it requires life sciences being brought from lab to village, and it also shows that the world is very flat. You know, our book is a little bit like the Thomas Friedman book, The World is Flat, which really talked about a flat world in terms of information and entertainment and how it was connected. Well, the story I just told you connects up Seattle and India and Geneva and West Africa, and that is what progress looks like in a flat world. Our book is really a story of hope and some early indicators of the delivery of that hope and the transformation that's happening in people's attitudes, where they recognize that some of the very same knowledge and technologies that can help make us healthier in Canada and the United States can also be used to a very great impact to improve the health of people in low and middle income countries.
So getting to that proverbial village would involve a great deal of funding, of course, and you need resources once there, so you need people. The importance of getting sort of these local advocates, what does that entail? Does that entail education? Does that obviously training them, right?
Yes, there is no single answer to what's needed. What's needed, first of all, is awareness that there are these problems. Then policymakers working with their populations to find solutions. Confidence to say we can do this, we don't need the rich countries to tell us what to do. Building capacity so that you can do what needs to be done. Collaborating with others outside, so it's not a one-way traffic. There is a lot of reverse learning in a way that, for example, Canada can learn how to provide health services at 1% of the cost as effectively. So there is quite complex. But the point is that you need to start thinking about these things, and you need to be able to put in place the kinds of policies and capacity that are needed, and you need to know how to go about doing that. So the only way in which the ordinary citizen, the scientists of the country, and the policymakers and the politicians can you know, make a difference in the long term, when you're looking at 50, 100 years from now, is to begin to be aware and to respect each other and talk to each other.
And so here's a couple of concrete examples. You know, Abdullah talked about the tragic death of his sister from malaria. That's a disease which is where the front line of prevention is bed nets that are treated with insecticide, and that insecticide lasts in the net for 5 years. Where do you think those bed nets come from? Well, in Africa, the largest manufacturer of those bed nets is a company in Arusha called A to Z Textile Mills, that makes 25 million bed nets, employs 6,000 people, and that actually is a big success story. Now imagine a world where there's 100 companies like that across Africa, small domestic companies making products that help people and employing people and protecting against malaria with those bed nets. That's the future world of hope we're talking about. Take another hopeful example. An even better way to prevent malaria might be a vaccine. And we don't have a malaria vaccine now, but there's one in late-stage clinical trials that is expected to be available in 2016. And that's coming from a partnership between the company GSK and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So there's a lot of hope and a lot of examples of using modern tools of life science, bringing them from lab to village and saving lives.
How do you find it, Dr. Dart, in terms of going to a village, say, and finding that the people there may not share the values that we have, or even the work ethic, say, and how do you make sure that we don't, impose our beliefs on them? I mean, is that something that you're finding a challenge in your work?
That's a really important question, and I think a large part of our book is addressing that by saying, don't come with solutions and try to impose them. You need to be able to listen to the people, engage them, and understand their needs, and if you're going to be introducing new interventions or technologies, you need to prepare the ground with them to be able to receive that kind of technology. So we went to a village, Peter and I, near Arusha, and we were interested to see how the bed nets that Peter just described were being used. And we went to a house in this poor village, and we met a grandmother with three of her children, grandchildren, and she showed us how she was using these bed nets and told us that as a result of the use of those bed nets, the children, the grandchildren, are no longer getting malaria. They're working harder. The family income has increased. And then we went outside and we asked her, where are you cooking? And she showed us a cooking shed. And we went in with her into the cooking shed, and we saw that she was cooking on three stones with charcoal, and the whole room was filled with smoke. So she was being protected from malaria by a simple technology of insecticide-impregnated bed nets, but exposing herself and her grandchildren and her neighbors to getting severe chronic lung disease from the kind of cooking stove, the cooking that she was using. And nearby in Kenya, they have a new kind of cooking stove made of ceramic that does not produce anywhere near as much smoke. Now, the questions arise, will this lady be able to afford such a cooking stove, even if it was cheap? Who would teach her how to use it? Would it be culturally acceptable if she could afford it but her neighbors could not? There are a lot of practical, sensible issues like that about how you take technology to the village. And as we pointed out earlier, you need to prepare the village for the intake of new technology. You don't just say, hey, there's a solution here. You know, give them leaflets where you can go buy it and go away. In fact, when the bed nets were being introduced, they were white in color. People in that part of the world associate white bed nets with death shrouds, and so they didn't use them until the company understood that in order to get the villagers to use them, they needed to change the color to blue, and once they changed the color to blue, people started using them. That's a great example of how you don't impose something. You try to understand it, you see where the resistance is, you talk to the village, they explain to you why they're not doing what's needed for them, and you discuss them all with them, all these issues, and slowly people uptake the technology.
I guess it's one thing that we go there and help, but the expectation from some people in this part of the world is that they have to do their part too. Can the partnership between the lab and the village, between the West and the developing world, can that be 50-50? Is it?
Sure, and this is all about those sorts of partnerships. You know, the book describes our 10-year journey together. From a time when people really didn't believe that innovation had much to do with global health, to a time when people fully understand that it does, and that the future arc is one that goes from dependency of people in developing countries on charity from the West to one of self-sufficiency. Those stories about A to Z textile mills and the bed nets, about the Indian company and the meningitis vaccine, and many other stories like that that we tell in the book are actually stories of self-sufficiency, of the lab getting close to the village. We talk about a lot of interesting people that we met along the way, and that's actually why the grandest challenge is a story of hope. It is one of people who are self-sufficient, and just to be a little cheeky about it, we will come to the point where there will be innovations in the developing world that will be useful in our healthcare. To take an example, when I was a medical student, learning to examine patients. I was using a stethoscope, a 200- or 300- or 400-year-old technology. I would have loved to have had a little thing I could hold in my hand that looked at patients' hearts, you know, like with ultrasound, and could actually image for me the heart or the liver of the patient that I was examining and caring for. That didn't exist at that time, but it does exist today. It was developed by GE, a handheld ultrasound device. It's called the V-Scan. And where do you think that was developed? It was developed at GE's research facility in India. Because talent is global. Yeah. The only question is whether we use it or not. And at the core, what this book is about is actually how we can stop wasting the talent and ideas of really brilliant young innovators in the developing world and start using them for the betterment of humanity, including not only people in the developing world, but also people in Canada and the United States, like the example of the V-Scan that I gave you. So it's a story of hope. It's a story of using science and innovation in global affairs. It's a story of how the future can be better than the present in the lives of people in low and middle income countries. And this isn't a pipe dream. We have stories of where it's happening. And we would love to open the eyes of readers to this very new world of possibility that will become a reality. We hope that your readers enjoy the journey that Abdullah and I have taken and what we've learned along the way and the people that we've met. Some of them have been very interesting and doing incredible things.
Indeed. Dr. Dhar, the model that you discuss in the book, I'm wondering if profit, is that something that you're considering in the work that you're doing, that making a profit out of this eventually, perhaps, to sustain it? Is that a goal?
No, if you mean personally, Peter and I, we are academics, we are researchers, we work in global health. We ourselves actually are both involved in funding research. Peter is the CEO of Grand Challenges Canada. I'm the chair of the Global Alliance for Chronic Diseases, which is another research funding agency. And our aim here is to make a difference in the world. Both of us gave up careers in patient contact type of medicine, where we could have made tons of money in order to work in this area. So the answer is no, we are personally not interested in making a buck out of the work that we do.
No, indeed, but I'm talking about in terms of sustaining these projects so that, you know, that they're funded, they're funding themselves, I should say.
Sustainability question is really important, and those examples we describe are examples of sustainability and sustainable demand. At the end of the day, we need to think of global health the same way we think of the economies in our own countries. I mean, what are the discussions happening now in terms of the economy in Canada? It's about growth. It's especially about jobs. It's about sustaining healthcare systems. I mean, those are the same issues that we need to start thinking about, but of course in a different and more innovative and more affordable way in low and middle income countries. And that example of A to Z textile mills is all about achieving health benefits and creating jobs both at the same time. The example of the meningitis vaccine is all about affordable innovations. That 50-cent vaccine created by the Indian company, it's about affordable innovation to have health effects and be able to afford them. And the example of the V-Scan is the really emerging frontier of south to north innovation, where we can learn from the south. So not only will we get to the point in the future where the developing countries won't be dependent on the United States and Canada, but we will get to a much more equal situation where we're learning from each other, and the world really is interconnected in the area of health and life sciences, and that will be a healthier, wealthier, fairer world, and that's the world we envision, and the world we argue will become a reality.
In terms of altering genes, are we there yet? I mean, we've identified certain genes that cause certain diseases, but in terms of altering something that occur in someone when they're old, how far are we at that, or are we there yet?
Well, the power of genomics and manipulating the gene is really quite stupendous. It is possible to, for example, treat certain kinds of leukemias in children with gene therapy by inserting different genes and manipulating the genome that way. In terms of reversing aging, if I understood your question correctly, no, we are not there yet. But obviously a lot of people are doing that kind of research. The kinds of genetic manipulations that we discuss in the book are all about how to make vaccines, how to make better drugs, how to make the vaccines that we have at the moment better, delivering them less frequently, for example, or not requiring refrigeration in order to be delivered. And the science that's addressing those kinds of issues is, in a way, much more important in terms of saving lives than manipulating genes to stop people from aging, although there is a lot of research going on there, too.
This is important and fascinating work that you're both doing. We'll be watching with interest. Good luck with this book.
Thank you.
Thank you, and we hope that it'll open people's eyes to the new world that's coming, and a different way of thinking about global affairs and a different way of thinking about the future of humanity.
Indeed, indeed. The book is called The Grandest Challenge, Taking Life-Saving Science from Lab to Village. It's published by Doubleday. Its authors, Dr. Abdallah Dar and Dr. Peter Singer, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Flatto.